It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. So there's a basket of yarn and a crochet hook in the corner. Could you use them to crochet the secrets of the universe?
Imagine that you'd never seen a sphere. You couldn't really imagine it, but it could be described with theories. And then one day somebody comes along and says, oh, you know what? Here's a model of a sphere. It's a beach ball. And suddenly you can see it in front of your eyes and you can draw lines on it and demonstrate properties of it. This is what Dr. Tamina did with the hyperbolic plane. Dr. Tamina is a Latvian mathematician who grew up in Latvia knitting and crocheting and also studying mathematics and computer science. And when she moved to the US, she heard about this hyperbolic structure and the fact that a lot of mathematicians didn't see how you could make a model of it. She thought about it and she realized she could do it with knitting and crochet. Really, the pattern or the formula for doing this, the algorithm really, is very simple. Crochet three stitches, increase one. Crochet three stitches, increase one. As long as you do it at a regular rate and then increase, get more and more stitches. That causes the model to go in curls or frills. What's funny about this is that women who've been knitting and crocheting or making ruffles for hundreds of years have actually been doing hyperbolic surfaces. They just didn't know.
So there you go. The geometric structure of the universe hidden for centuries in crochet. This is Margaret Wertheim. She's a physicist, writer, and mathematician, and she's also the creator of the Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef Project. This is the biggest community art and science project in the world. And she says, you want to understand the nature of the universe? Pick up a crochet hook. I actually brought my crocheting, and I've been trying one of your projects.
Oh, good.
I am crocheting in aqua blue acrylic pseudosphere.
Ah, right. Okay.
I'm going to put it down so we can talk. But it's very pretty.
It is, yes.
I'm actually more of a knitter. But how did you get interested in this intersection of math or physics and needlework? I mean, did you crochet as a girl?
I did. I grew up knitting and crocheting and doing needlepoint. My mum taught me most of those skills when I was very young, and all through high school and university, I knitted and crocheted and sewed all my own clothes.
Oh, wow.
And when I heard about Dr. Tamina's invention of hyperbolic crochet, I thought, this is just brilliant, that by crocheting, you can be exploring in your hand the possible geometries of the universe.
That's sort of like the secret order to the universe that women have known or intuited.
Well, no, not only women, but corals and kelps and nudibranchs and sea slugs and lots of reef organisms have been making these hyperbolic structures. So, you know, we all recognize pictures of coral reefs, largely because when we see reefs, they're full of these frilly, crenellated and curvy forms. And all of those are biological manifestations of hyperbolic geometry. And these hyperbolic structures, everybody sees them pretty regularly. They're in the lettuce leaves in your salad.
I was going to say, this pale blue thing I'm making kind of looks like very, very frilly kale.
That's right, yes.
I'm curious, Margaret, you came up with this whole crochet coral reef project that people all around the world have crocheted variations on this thing I'm making. But does this relate in any way to the nature of space?
Well, this whole question of does space itself has a structure has come up in the wake of the discovery of hyperbolic space. So you can look at it like this. If you look at any curved surface, like take a kale leaf, let's say it's fairly irregular kale leaf. Mm-hmm. Some parts of it will be more frilly than others.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a perfect hyperbolic structure. It's a wonky one. Now, if you can imagine a surface that's got sort of arbitrary frills and curly bits here and there and everywhere, all of different kinds, why not ask the question, well, is space itself curly?
So is it possible that I am sitting here crocheting an aqua blue model of the universe?
Possibly not, because if the universe is hyperbolic, it will actually have a more structure, a more complex structure than a simple hyperbolic plane, which is what you're crocheting. But it would be a cousin of it, yes.
I'm looking at my blue crocheting. I'm sort of ridiculously pleased with it, but I'm actually increasing every stitch. So as you can imagine, it's just this explosion.
It's going berserk.
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. The more quickly you increase, of course, the faster it will hyperbolicize.
I just love it that you're talking about bringing together a traditionally, really almost archetypally feminine art with math and physics, which have been dominated by men for centuries. That must feel so significant to you.
It does. It does, actually. And for me, it was never a tension, because it's clear when you're doing handicrafts, you know this as a knitter, that these are highly algorithmic processes. You know, knitting and crocheting patterns are very elaborate algorithms. They're essentially the same thing as pieces of computer code.
That's fascinating. You're making me think knitting is much more complex than I thought.
Oh, yes. And let's not forget that, in fact, you know, these are literally the original digital technologies. You know, I'm knitting and crocheting with my fingers. And it's also the case that computer punch cards were derived from the cards that were originally used for giving instructions to weaving machines.
Wait, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. The original punch cards were created to drive Jacquard looms in the 19th century. And then they were later developed to be the punch cards to input data onto computers. So there's a very, very direct lineage from handicrafts into computing, which feminist scholars of science have been pointing out for a long, long time. And yet we still have this sort of, as it were, deeply ingrained myth in our society that somehow handicraft and women's activities, you know, don't have much to do with computation. But that's just really a myth.
Do you think that knitting and crocheting are not just algorithmic in the sense that they've got code embedded in them, but do you think there's something fundamentally mathematical about them?
So one way of that I describe it is that you can ask the question, what is mathematics? Well, one answer to that question is that mathematics is the language of pattern and form. And it's also a language for describing structures. That's literally what geometry and topology do. So if that's what math is, then that's exactly what handicrafts are doing.
Wow.
They're making very complex patterned structures and volumetric or, you know, multidimensional structures. So I think it's absolutely that handicrafts is a form of embodied mathematics.
Wow. You, as a physicist, I mean, what do you think about while you're crocheting? I'm sure that there are, you know, sometimes you're just like paying attention to whatever you're watching on television or you're talking with your sister. But is it possible for you to get into a kind of almost a meditative state where you're crocheting and you're also kind of pondering the nature of reality and the mathematical order that underlies the cosmos?
Yes, yes, indeed. And one of the things that has arisen in doing the Crochet Coral Reef project is that you start to think, well, what kinds of structures are possible with this? What if could I make a branching structure that's hyperbolic? Could I make a tubular structure that's hyperbolic? What if I put a bit of a hyperbolic frill here and go, you know, and combine it with a bit of a spherical thing over there? And so what this becomes is a form of ongoing material experimental mathematics.
Do you think that rather than using math to invent new patterns for crocheting, do you think it might be possible to use crochet to discover new kinds of math?
So here's some questions. When we crochet these forms, you know from your crocheting of them that as you go along, you get more ruffles. So at some point, as you're crocheting along, it goes from, say, 2 ruffles, suddenly it goes into 3 ruffles, and then a bit later it goes into 4 ruffles. Now, Chrissy and I have been doing this a lot, and we've come to understand that if we work with a particular kind of yarn, we can predict when it will go from 2 ruffles to 3 ruffles to 4 ruffles. So I've asked mathematicians, from just doing math, could you know when it would go from 2 to 3?
Huh.
And the answer is no, you can't. Just studying the math, you've got no way of knowing.
But you can in crochet.
Yes. So when you're crocheting, what you're doing by embodying the mathematical forms is you're beginning to explore what is effectively a kind of physics. And we've learned that you really can begin to understand a lot about the physics of these things through doing it.
You're kind of suggesting that there's a link between creating with a small c and the creation with a capital C.
Yes, well, you know, for several thousand years in, you know, ever since the ancient Greeks, God has been seen as some sort of artisan. And then, you know, in the 17th century with the Scientific Revolution, he got conceived as being a mathematical creator. So this is where we get the idea that, you know, people like Stephen Hawking are looking for the equations in the mind of God, the notion that God has created the universe according to mathematical laws. But I think, you know, we could also say that, you know, God is the great handicrafter.
God is knitting the world.
Crocheting universe. Or she's crocheted a universe.
Margaret Wertheim is a physicist, mathematician, and writer. She and her twin sister Christine created the Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef, which is the biggest art and science community project in the world. And if you want to know more, check out Margaret's Field Guide to Hyperbolic Space, or take a look at the photos we posted online. That's at ttbook.org. Or maybe you just want to get started.
I believe it's always nice for people to start off making a simple, geometrically correct hyperbolic plane. You crochet in stitches, increase one, keep going. The more stitches you wait before you increase, the slower it will be ruffling up. What's lovely to think about as you watch the model get ever more ruffly is that what you're doing is you're actually adding surface, the geometric equivalent of the negative numbers. So just as people develop positive numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they ask themselves, well, oh, is there something on the other side of 0? And they realise, oh, we could have -1, -2, -3, -4. A flat piece of paper, it has no curvature, so it's 0 curvature. A sphere is positive curvature, and then it makes sense, doesn't it, that there should be a negative curvature space, and that's the surfaces that you're ruffling. I love to think while I'm crocheting that what I'm doing is crocheting the geometric equivalent of a negative number.
From crocheting the universe to a story of math, God, and obsession. A story that begins with a question. What would you do with a pencil in a Soviet prison?
He took that pencil and wasted no time getting back to his favorite pastime, solving math problems.
On toilet paper.
Yes, on squares of toilet paper in the psych ward, believe it or not, he managed to refute a famous solution to the dimension subgroup conjecture, a problem that had baffled mathematicians around the world for decades.
I'm Anne Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Sometimes you can take math too far, dig too deep, and end up drowned in your own numbers. So this is a story of one famous mathematician's obsession with the ancient and mystical and numerical world of the Kabbalah. It's our latest collaboration with the podcast Israel Story, and this one comes from Shlomo Maital.
Did God, or whoever you believe authored the Bible, sprinkle it with secret messages? And are we just now starting to uncover their true meaning? This is a story about these questions, questions that have kept theologians, mathematicians, statisticians, journalists, and politicians very busy. But at the same time, this is also a story about a man, his faith, and the lengths to which he was willing to go to stand by his beliefs.
My name is Eliyahu Rips. Actually, when I was born, it was Eliyahu Rips. I was born in Riga.
Riga, the capital of Latvia, was then part of the Soviet Union. Today, Eliyahu is a professor of mathematics at Jerusalem's Hebrew University. He's also an ultra-Orthodox Jew. So, picture him. He has a long white beard, peis or side locks, a wide-brimmed black hat, and some blackboard chalk powder on the left lapel of his jacket. Yes, apparently Hebrew University's math department still uses chalkboards. Our story begins way back when Eliyahu was still Ilya, a 20-year-old clean-shaven student in the mathematics department at the University of Latvia.
In the beginning of 1968 began the so-called Spring of Prague.
The Prague Spring was a brief period of cultural and political upheaval in Czechoslovakia, while the country was essentially a Soviet satellite. It began on January 5, 1968, when a local reformer, a guy by the name of Alexander Dubček, was elected to be the first secretary of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia has perhaps never experienced such a celebration, free and spontaneous.
By the end of that summer, an alarmed Kremlin had sent Soviet troops to invade Czechoslovakia, putting a violent end to the democratic reforms. Ilya followed these dramatic unfolding events on his shortwave radio, tuning into foreign broadcasts like the Voice of America and the BBC.
It was a very sad feeling of despair, of hopelessness, of being able to do nothing. Everything was gloomy.
Young, passionate, and restless, Ilya decided that he couldn't just sit around moping. He felt he simply had to act.
To express my protest about what is going on.
So he prepared a makeshift banner and scribbled a fairly straightforward slogan on it. I protest against the occupation of Czechoslovakia. He then stuffed his coat and pant pockets with gasoline-soaked rags, walked over to the Freedom Statue in Riga's main square, unfolded his banner, and spread it out on the floor beside him.
This was the most difficult thing I did in my life. This was a point of no return.
Then he struck a match and set himself on fire.
I remember the flame on his hand and on the neck. But then I don't remember.
Just by chance, a group of sailors passing by saw him. They threw their heavy overcoats on him and extinguished the fire. When he regained consciousness, he was surrounded by strangers.
Then a person came from this crowd and arrested me. They brought me first to the Interior Ministry, then to the KGB.
Were you happy to find that you were still alive? How did you feel about your plan failing?
You see, the fear disappeared.
Ilya was thrown in jail, interrogated, and charged with crimes of anti-Soviet behavior. But he wasn't found guilty at his trial. Instead, he was simply proclaimed insane and consigned to a closed psychiatric ward.
At this time, the preferred tactics of the regime was to present people protesting are insane. And actually, it could be for indefinite number of years.
Fortunately for him, he had some admirers among the psych ward staff, people who secretly supported his protest and viewed him as a hero. He discovered this the very first morning when he woke up to find
under my pillow the finest kind of sukaria, Misha Kosolapohi, the most expensive candy that you have in the Soviet Union.
A piece of candy just laying there. But even more significant was the pencil that was placed right next to it. He took that pencil and wasted no time getting back to his favorite pastime, solving math problems.
On toilet paper.
Yes, on squares of toilet paper in the psych ward. Believe it or not, he managed to refute a famous solution to the dimension subgroup conjecture, a problem that had baffled mathematicians around the world for decades. It didn't take long before word of Ilya's discovery reached the Western scientific community. The mystique surrounding a young and brilliant mathematician stuck in a Soviet psychiatric ward grew. Soon, an international lobby began to fight for his release.
The Russians did not like to have an embarrassment, so it turned out that my condition suddenly improved. The institution sent me home.
But he knew he could never fully be safe behind the Iron Curtain. So after some more pressure, Ilya and his family managed to obtain visas and...
In the January 72, we were here in Israel.
Math had literally saved Ilya from the clutches of the Soviet psych ward, but it would ultimately lead him, as unlikely as that sounds, to even darker corners. At just 23, with the eyes of the mathematical world fixed upon him, Ilya, now Eliyahu, enrolled in the Hebrew University, where he quickly finished his PhD.
And then I was accepted to the staff, and since then I'm working here.
Eliyahu settled down, and everything seemed to be going his way. He got married, had kids, and spent his days teaching math. In yet another break with his Soviet past, he was also becoming increasingly religious and began attending a daily minyan, or morning prayers. It was a mundane lifestyle, really, that is, apart from being a rock star in the combinatorial group theory scene. Then, one day, as he was praying in a small synagogue in Ramat Gan, he stumbled upon a little book.
Chidushei Torah.
It was a compilation of drashot, or sermons, given by Rabbi Michael Bear Weissmandel, a Slovakian Holocaust survivor, to his congregants. As Eliyahu perused it, he came across a
few pages in which they recollected what he told them about his findings of skipping the Torah with equal intervals. And of course, we all understand he did it without a computer. And this is just a spark of the genius.
Let me explain this whole skipping the Torah with equal intervals business. Suppose you pick a text, Harry Potter, for example. Now, erase all the punctuation marks and the spaces between the words, and you end up with a very long list of letters. Then, select a certain number, let's say 7. Circle the 7th letter of the text, skip 7 again. Circle the 14th letter, skip 7 again. Circle the 21st, and so on. Finally, check to see if anything meaningful emerges from all the circle letters. That's exactly what Rabbi Weissmandel did. And he detected what seemed to him to be messages that could not occur by chance. As he was reading about this at shul that day, Eliyahu thought to himself that it would be an interesting experiment to take Rabbi Weissmandel's work and try to prove it mathematically. Now, it's important to Eliyahu that we clarify he wasn't looking for predictions, just statistical anomalies.
I looked for the first 13 letters in the book of Leviticus for the word Aaron.
He wanted to check how many times that name, Aharon, the brother of Moses, appeared when skipping equal distances in Leviticus.
I already knew that the mathematical expectation to find is 8.3 times, and it turned out that it was 25 times.
So in case you didn't catch that, Aharon is supposed to occur 8.3 times, but in fact Eliyahu found it occurred 25 times. The probability of that happening by accident, randomly, was nearly zero. Eliyahu was dumbfounded.
Unforgettable moment. I became convinced that this could be studied by scientific means.
Following that initial surprising find, Eliyahu went on to devise a more comprehensive experiment. He picked 34 prominent rabbis and checked how many times, using the equidistant letter spacing method, their names showed up in the book of Genesis. He then compared that number to what he would have expected to find, statistically speaking. Separately, he also looked into whether the occurrence of those rabbis' names in the text happened to be next to a stretch of letters that corresponded to their dates of birth and death. Eliyahu and his two research partners, Doron Witzdum and Yoav Rosenberg, discovered uncanny correlations between the names and the dates. The math involved is extremely complicated, but the bottom line was that this was really, really unlikely. In any event, they wrote up their findings and submitted their paper to a well-respected journal called Statistical Science.
I had the conviction that science looks impassionate, search for truth.
The paper ended up on the desk of the journal's editor, Robert E. Cass, a famous statistics professor from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He was completely baffled. On the one hand, he didn't believe it for a second. The entire idea seemed utterly preposterous. But on the other hand, he couldn't find a single methodological or computational flaw in the draft of the article. Not knowing what else to do, he sent out the paper to independent peer reviewers. He was certain they would quickly point out the errors, debunk the argument, and then he could scrap it in good conscience. End of story. But the thing is, they couldn't. So Cass brought in his senior editors for a consultation. Here he is.
One person in particular argued strongly against publication. He effectively predicted exactly what would happen. And I decided that for the benefit of the field of statistics, we should publish it.
They published it quite unusually with a kind of editorial note at the beginning of that issue of the journal saying, you know, we published this as kind of a challenge to our readers. This finding seems bizarre. We don't really believe it. But, you know, we're scientists. This study was carried out in accordance with, like, usual practices. And so it wouldn't really be fair not to publish it. But just so you know, we think it's weird.
That's Jordan Ellenberg.
I'm a professor of mathematics here at the University of Wisconsin at Madison.
Ellenberg, who devoted a whole chapter to RIPS and the Bible Code in his latest book, How Not to Be Wrong, is actually the one who got us onto this whole saga. Back in 1994, when the article came out, Ellenberg was in graduate school.
I mean, I think my initial reaction was the same as that of a lot of people, which was that something must be wrong with this.
And Ellenberg wasn't alone.
It became a huge craze in the United States, this idea that that there were secret messages. I mean, people here in the U.S. are pretty interested in the Bible as it is, as you know, and even more so, right, when there's kind of fascinating secret messages which foretell the future.
One of those who jumped on the RIPS bandwagon was an American journalist by the name of Michael Drosnin. In 1997, he published a book titled The Bible Code, which took Eliyahu's statistical observations one crucial step further.
I found encoded in the Bible a prediction of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin a year before he was killed.
This was precisely what Cass's editors had feared, that quasi-scientists and non-academics would take the finding they had published and run with it in all kinds of crazy directions. This is Drosnin talking to Charlie Rose on PBS.
I immediately flew to Israel. I gave this in a letter to a close friend of the prime minister, a poet named Chaim Guri, who had known Rabin since childhood and won Israel's two top literary prizes. And I said, please give this to your friend. I don't know that he's in actual danger, but I do know that his assassination is very clearly encoded. And if I were him, I would take this very seriously, because the Bible Code also details the assassinations of both Kennedys and Anwar Sadat.
Drosnin, quite simply, was using Eliyahu's methods, or at least his version of them, to predict the future, and his predictions were making the rounds. The media was loving it.
Every major event in world history,
and the general public was eating it up.
History appears to be encoded in the Bible.
Drosnin's book made the New York Times bestseller list, and even Oprah invited him to appear on her show.
Stehen in der Bibel geheime Botschaften.
A code that tells of events far into the future.
We might face the real Armageddon.
La predicción del Armagedón en la Biblia.
In all his media appearances, Drosnin made sure to mention that his book was based on a major publication, that is, Eliyahu Rips's article. While Drosnin's Bible Code was selling like hotcakes, the scientific community was mortified. My favorite demonstration of that embarrassment comes from mathematician Dave Thomas, who worked hard to find his own secret message encoded in the Bible. The Bible Code, it read, is a silly, dumb, fake, false, evil, nasty, dismal fraud and snake oil hoax. But while Drosnin could be dismissed as a crackpot, mathematicians around the world were still enthralled and confused by Eliyahu's seemingly rigorous and robust publication. One of them was all the way over in Canberra, Australia.
I'm Brendan McKay. I'm just retired as a computer scientist at the Australian National University, and I specialize in combinatorial mathematics and probability theory. When I first heard about these claims, I was excited because I've had as a sort of hobby the debunking of claims like this for a very long time. But because Rips is such an excellent mathematician and because the paper they published was written so carefully in order to not expose the weak points in their case, it was quite a difficult debunking task.
McKay wasn't only intrigued, but also spurred to action. He spent a long time trying to refute Eliyahu's claims, and he didn't get very far. At the same time, and on the other side of the globe, a group of Eliyahu's own colleagues from the Hebrew University were also working on a rebuttal. They had heard of McKay's efforts and decided to give him a call. They said,
"Look, we're working on this too. Why don't you come to Israel? We'll work on it together." And that's how I got started.
It took them 3 years, but eventually another paper appeared in the same journal, Statistical Science. The joint Aussie-Israeli team basically replicated Eliyahu's experiment with one major difference.
The famous experiment of Rips and his co-workers compared names and dates of birth and death of famous rabbis from Jewish history in the text of Genesis. We did the same thing in the text of War and Peace, and we proved, where the word proved is in quotation marks, that War and Peace predicted these correspondences between the rabbis and their dates of death.
Basically, they showed that these statistical anomalies could exist in any long text, that the Bible did not, as many people thought Eliyahu's research had shown, contain a secret code. Almost overnight, Eliyahu went from being a well-respected member of the academic community to being a derided and ridiculed mathematician.
We were buried. So it seemed.
Now, while McKay and company merely claimed to uncover flaws in Eliyahu's scientific method, others went so far as accusing him of intentionally falsifying the data by cherry-picking the names that came up with the best correlations.
I would not have called him a charlatan. I would have not have called him a fake. I didn't question his motives. It's just that it never surprised me that he got this wrong, or at least I think he got it wrong.
That's Robert Cass, the journal's editor, once again.
So I never thought that, you know, he was deliberately distorting things. That wasn't the point. The point was actually a more important one, because someone who really means well and believes in what they're doing can make a very basic mistake.
This is really a con you can pull on yourself.
Here's Jordan Ellenberg again.
You can fool yourself without being a sort of evil person who's trying to fool other people. They wanted this to be true. That's the hardest kind of con to defeat, the one you run on yourself.
Despite his tarnished reputation, Eliyahu still believes he's right and that he's onto something so big, so incredibly huge, that people have a hard time accepting it. Eliyahu thinks that the statistical anomalies he unearthed can only be explained by the fact that the Bible was written by God, a God who knows the future. But down here, in the terrestrial world of math and statistics departments, his claims have been regarded as somewhere between wrong and fraudulent. And this is, he says, an accusation more painful, more paralyzing than setting himself on fire. For the last 20 years, he's been trying to publish another paper, responding to the allegations leveled against him with further proof of his biblical correlations.
The journal did not allow us to respond.
So in principle, I think it would be reasonable for them to absolutely to consider such a letter.
Robert Cass is no longer the journal's editor, but he agreed to answer my hypothetical.
I have to tell you, I have trouble imagining what he could say that would materially change anything. And the very fact that he continues to believe it, that's not publication worthy.
In many ways, Eliyahu feels that this state of academic shame is worse than the Soviet prison, or the closed psychiatric ward.
I must say that somehow, maybe because then I was young, I didn't feel it scratch me. And here, this controversy was a real suffering. You see, there was a saying in the Soviet Union, to be in prison is difficult only for the first 10 years. So I'm kind of the intellectual prison. Just I have to do what I can do, that's all.
Still, despite the entire firestorm, Robert Cass doesn't regret publishing Eliyahu's paper. That's just how science and knowledge in general advance, he told me. People put their ideas out there, and others scrutinize them. Many new ideas will get shot down, but once in a while an idea will stick and generate new ideas.
Is society ultimately served by this process? I would argue that in the long run, yes, it is, because people will come to appreciate all of these subtleties. They will come to appreciate even better that it's hard to be sure or to be confident about patterns in complicated data and what they mean. And that's the ultimate lesson of the story, that there is subtlety there and you have to be very careful.
But Eliyahu doesn't agree. For him, it's not about subtlety or an evolutionary process of natural selection of ideas. As far as he is concerned, it's a story of a misunderstood scientist who made an astounding discovery, one his peers were too scared or too reluctant to acknowledge. In the meantime, stuck in an academic limbo, Eliyahu continues to do the exact same thing that helped keep him sane back in the Soviet psych ward. Math. I met up with him a couple of times to record his story. And at the very end of our last interview, Eliyahu excitedly pulled out a thick binder from his briefcase and handed it to me.
Here is some new thing that was done by Doron Wittstum. And curiously, I obtained this paper just this Friday.
As he told me this, he had a big smile on his face and seemed almost radiant. Eliyahu and his longtime research partner, Doron Wittstum, had recently made some new discoveries.
He had the following idea.
It could, he said, be big.
This is extremely important new data. It overturns the tables on this discussion. It surely deserves a major publication. At least you have found me at this point when I still did not lose the hope.
Eliyahu Rips, you see, is far from giving up.
Who knows? Let us hope.
Shlomo Maital brought us that story. He's a retired professor of economics at the Naaman Institute of the Technion in Haifa, and he worked with the great folks at the podcast Israel Story, including Yochai Maital, Mishi Harman, and Julie Subrin, with original scoring by Ruth Danan. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. So, what animal would be brilliant at physics?
I think birds would be very good, but dogs not so much. Let me explain. The dog's world is a world primarily based on smell. It's very, very hard to get from sensations of smell to Newton's laws of motion, for instance, in mechanics. Spiders would have a different perspective. They communicate through touch and vibrations of their webs. They would have a very good entry into field theory, you know, and the idea that the world is controlled by vibrations or electric and magnetic fields, they would find very congenial, and they probably could get to that pretty rapidly. It's just humans, who are primarily visual animals, we have the capability of seeing things very, very far away. We're lucky that we can see the planets, and that gives us a nice opening into astronomy and understanding gravity. Birds would have all that and more, because whereas our experience is dominated by friction and the force of gravity here on Earth, birds would just experience that in their everyday life. You know, they beat their wings for a while, then stop, and they just glide. So they know about inertia. They experience that every day. Birds, if they became intelligent, would make more rapid progress on physics than humans.
I wish I was a bird. This is Frank Wilczek. He's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist at MIT, and he's kind of obsessed, in his own way, with understanding the universe. And specifically, he's interested in what he calls the beautiful question. Is the universe naturally, inherently beautiful? So, of course, Steve Paulson wanted an answer.
Frank, the question you're asking, is there beauty in the design of nature, would seem to be a matter of aesthetics. Is this also a scientific question?
It is a scientific question. It has two sides, at least. The exact question I'm trying to address is, does the world embody beautiful ideas? And that's a question about the world on the one hand and beauty on the other.
Does this matter? I mean, for a scientist, does it matter if the world is beautiful, if it's a work of art?
Well, I don't think of science as something walled off from the rest of life. So it matters. Yes, it matters to me a lot whether the world is beautiful. You know, I hope that it would be. It also is, in a strange way, a practical question for physicists and others, engineers, designers. Specifically, for instance, at the frontiers of physics, we're dealing with realms of the very small or the very large and the very strange, where the source of intuition is not so much from everyday experience or from massive accumulation of facts, but from feelings of what would make sense, what would make things harmonize, what would make the laws have more inner coherence, more beauty. And my work has very much been guided by trying to make the laws more beautiful.
Well, I want to pick up this idea of beauty and take it back even further in history. I mean, because it's an ancient idea. I mean, it goes back to the ancient Greek philosophers, right?
Yes. Especially Pythagoras and Plato yearned for beauty in the description of the physical world. Pythagoras famously said all things are numbers, and believed in the music of the spheres, and even thought he heard the music of the spheres and wanted the harmony. The laws he discovered were laws of harmony and proportion.
In the Pythagoreans, I mean, there was a branch of it that actually became a religion, a kind of mystical cult.
It was a religion. It was, I think, as far as I know, the world's only mathematical religion. They are, in a sense, number worshippers, number mystics.
What would that mean to worship numbers?
Well, it's if you find concepts like music of the spheres attractive and a way of helping to understand the way things work, and you find that one of the great goals of life should be to understand the world better and understand it quantitatively, that's a kind of worship of numbers. You know, I think many modern scientists, not in an organized way and not with a theology, but they have very much the same kind of spirit of trying to understand the deep structure of the world. And that's their goal. That's what they find rewarding. That's their mission in life. And so it's not so different from Pythagoreanism.
So are you a modern Pythagorean yourself?
Yeah, among other things. Right? I can understand that and sympathize with it a lot, yeah.
Well, and then Plato talked about how there were these perfect forms that were sort of the underlying reality. I mean, what we see in the physical world is basically just an illusion, but there was some—
An imperfect copy. It was his idea. It was that there was an ideal cat of which all existing cats are just imperfect copies, for instance. And this, at some level, was an attempt to reconcile the aspirations of the Pythagoreans to perfect harmony and perfect structure and perfect regularity with the fact that the world that we actually experience certainly has messy aspects and imperfections.
Well, then Plato had that allegory about the cave. It's sort of like, you know, we're all prisoners chained in the cave, and all we see are the flickering shadows of the real people who are outside the cave. And it's kind of a profoundly pessimistic view of what we can actually understand about the world, isn't it?
Well, it's a pessimistic view of what we do understand about the world, and well, it also depends on who we are. but it's the idea that if you don't try to get beyond and escape the cave, that ordinary experience gives you only a very, very partial view of reality. But there's a world outside that's bigger and brighter and more ideal that you can hope to access if you study Platonic philosophy, or more generally, if you, you know, sort of escape from the everyday experiences and get beyond them, enhance your perception using instruments, using insight, then you can experience much more of reality. So I view it optimistically, actually, saying, so it's a statement that, yes, perception is limited, but that, if you think about it, that's also a challenge. Let's do better.
You know, in some ways, you strike me as being somewhat unusual for a scientist. I mean, you clearly love art. You have a strong philosophical bent. You love exploring these big ideas. Did you ever think about becoming a philosopher rather than a physicist?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. When I was a teenager, my heroes, I guess, were Einstein on the one hand, but Bertrand Russell on the other. I loved reading Bertrand Russell's books and reading about philosophy and thinking about those kinds of questions. And
why did you become a physicist then?
Well, I really liked mathematics. I liked playing with patterns always and thinking about that kind of abstraction. And I was good at it. But physics at that time was tremendously exciting and fruitful, and I decided that, you know, this was what was happening, and so I jumped in that direction.
So we've been talking about sort of philosophy and physics, and it's worth pointing out that in the last few years, some very high-profile physicists, from Stephen Hawking to Lawrence Krauss to Neil deGrasse Tyson, have all made rather disparaging comments about philosophers, basically saying that what they do does not have much value anymore to the real world of science. What do you make of these attacks on philosophy by your colleagues?
I think it shows lack of imagination and lack of knowledge, frankly, of what philosophy is all about. There's a lot about the world besides the laws of physics and the laws of astronomy and the phenomena of physical science. I mean, I've derived tremendous inspiration, as did Einstein, by the way, from the philosophical literature, from sharpening your mind against David Hume or Ernst Mach or Bertrand Russell. They have a lot to offer.
Of course, the real question that philosophers ask is not just how everything fits together, but does it have meaning? Does the universe or do the laws of physics have meaning? Does that question have resonance for you?
Yes, of course. How could you not think? Yeah, I mean, I very much care about what it all means. That's what drives a lot of what I do. And, you know, having derived what it is, then you can hardly help thinking about what it means.
Okay, so what does it mean?
Well, I don't think that's the right question in that form, actually, because I'm not sure what an answer to it would look like. You can always, okay, so if it means A, then you say, what does A mean? If it means B, what does B mean? You know, but I was very happy to come up with a version of that question, which is not the same, but I think has some of the elements of it and can be answered or can be addressed in a very fruitful way, which is exactly the question, does the world embody beautiful ideas? And that's a question that you can look at in a very enlightening way because you can compare what people's ideas about beauty have been historically before they knew the laws of physics and what they hoped for and what we've actually found. You can compare and get an enriched perspective on both art and science from that.
So basically what you're saying is if you need, if there's some part of you, not just you personally, but anyone, needs some sort of deeper system of values to fall back on. I mean, to sort of to give you sustenance to keep on going, yeah. Beauty would not be a bad place to look for it.
Yes. Some people derive joy and understanding from received dogmas of different religions, and that's a possible way to organize your life. Myself, I don't find that possible because I don't find any of the received religions do justice to what I know about the physical world, what I've discovered during my career. It's not so much that they're wrong, although many details are wrong, but that they just don't do justice to the profound surprises that science turns up about how things actually work and how big the universe it is, how old it is, how many little things go into making up the big things we experience in life. So that means it's on us to figure out, to make a meaning, to discover the meaning. And for me, one of the big discoveries about that goes in that direction of what it all means is that it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. And that's guided a lot of my work and has been a great source of joy.
I hope you find something beautiful today. That's Nobel Prize-winning physicist Frank Wilczek talking with Steve Paulson about his book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design. Steve also wrote a longer article about Wilczek for Nautilus magazine, and you can find that on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Our resident romantic, Charles Monroe Kane, produced this hour. He had help from digital guru Mark Rickers, our resident crazy Canadian, Doug Gordon. Joe Hartke is our technical director and sonic mastermind. Steve Paulson is my husband and our executive producer, and I'm your host, Anne Strainchamps. See you next time.